Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel.
Today, I'm going to speak with Clarice DeCruz. Clarice is a governance expert who provides training and board support to help boards unleash their potential. Having spent 25 years as a governance lawyer advising charities on how to navigate their way out of tricky governance situations, her current focus is on supporting boards to prevent problems arising and enable their organizations to deliver even greater impact through good governance. Clarice, welcome to Tolerable Risk. I'm really excited to have you on the show today to talk about the bigger picture around governance and how it relates to strategy and risk. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sabrina. And yeah, delighted to be able to build on some of your previous podcasts about what governance is all about.
Wonderful. So for people who might not be familiar with you or the work that you do, particularly all of the amazing work that you do around third sector stuff, can you just tell people a little bit more about your background and how you've gotten into the third sector work that you do?
Absolutely. So I qualified as a barrister. We're talking about the early 1990s. Even before I qualified as a lawyer, I knew I had a really deep connection with the charity sector. And that actually came from my time at university when I was on what's called here the League's RAG Committee. It's basically the fundraising society for the university. So I had that really deep calling, I would say, towards the charity sector. And that became really obvious to me when I was putting together a CV and someone said, take all of that charity stuff out. We need to look more commercial. And I thought, no, that's the bit that really matters. And so what I did is I left the bar and I went and worked in-house at a charity because we're talking mid-1990s. So the discipline of being a charity lawyer didn't actually really exist at that time. But I was incredibly fortunate in that I joined an organization, which was largely an arts-based organization, Interchange Trust, but it had a legal advisory arm, Interchange Legal Advisory Service, and it was a legal advisory service for other charities in the sector. So that's how I really got into it. A golden opportunity then presented itself to me to go and work with the Charity Commission in the in-house legal team there. So I got to understand and really got some invaluable insights into that regulatory perspective. So my life took me away from London up to Newcastle. I spent 2 years doing that commute in order to sustain the job at the Charity Commission so I could develop my knowledge and experience from that regulatory perspective. I then spent the vast majority of my legal career working with in-law firms, advising charities on governance and constitutional matters. That was for about 21 years. So I saw all the hot soup that charities got themselves into. And what I found, I've always done training and advisory work, but what I was finding increasingly was that if people only knew some of the basics around good governance, they'd avoid the hot soup, they'd avoid the problems that they had got themselves into. So about 2 years ago, I moved away from doing that kind of work, the cure, as I would call it, from a legal perspective. And very much I'm concentrating now on supporting boards, upskilling people on their good governance duties and responsibilities. It's the prevention side of things. So that's how I've got to where I am now, where I am doing board facilitation work, training work, and equity, diversity, equality work to support boards.
What an amazing background, Clarice. I know, as a recovering attorney myself for many, many years, there's so many social impact and social good lawyers out there who really would love to have the career that you just described, being able to still work for a private sector law firm, but being able to support those third sector organizations that really are delivering purpose and impact in the world. And your regulator perspective, I know, is going to come in really handy for what we're going to talk about today, but that must have been fascinating as well. And I love how you describe the challenges as falling into the hot soup. I'm going to have to use that phrase moving forward. I think that's great.
Let me regulate a bit. I would say has given me some unique perspectives. I think having worked in-house at a charity, having worked as an advisor, and the regulatory perspective, you sort of get a very rounded view of some of the issues that individual charities, but as the sector as a whole grapple with from time to time. So I certainly wouldn't have given that up. And if we worked remotely, Sabrina, I'd still probably be doing that job because it was so impactful. We did try this commute and it just became really, really challenging.
I think that multifaceted point of view, I find, at least from my experience, has been wonderful. I've worked for donors. I've worked for large organizations, small organizations. I've been in the field implementing programs, and being able to draw back on each of those experiences really helps to give you sort of a fuller picture when you are advising these organizations and helps you understand challenges from a really different perspective. So I'm super excited that we're having you on the podcast today to talk about these things, and you can bring all of these wonderful years of expertise to the listeners today. So let's dive into our conversation today. We're going to talk about governance, but from a strategic point of view. And really the question, how does governance help everything fit together? How do we make these puzzle pieces fit together? So I'm going to start out with the same question that I always like to start out with people is, when it comes to governance, but particularly this high level strategic concept of governance, what do you think people get wrong? What do they misunderstand about it? And what do they mistakenly believe that governance, when it comes to strategy, entails and requires?
I think there are two aspects to this that people sort of at the higher level misunderstand. And the first thing is what the essence of good governance is all about. And I think sometimes what that means is that senior leaders, charity trustees, and even then in the not-for-profits, you know, the boards and the senior leadership teams there, they can have, not all, but they can have a tendency to look at governance through the wrong lens. They're looking at it as a compliance thing. They're looking at it as a periodical task and finish job. They see it sometimes as a constraint. It's almost stopping them from doing what they may want to do. And I would really recommend that your listeners refer back to and listen to the podcast you and Patty Blackstaff did about good governance, because it resonated so much with what I think in that higher level, bigger picture way good governance is all about. What it's really about is empowering an organization to deliver on its charitable purposes, its vision and its mission with even greater impact. It's about organizational integrity. It's about having the right cultures and values and behaviors. And at that high level, if you understand good governance in those terms, it has the opposite effect that some people think. It actually unleashes the potential of an organization. It all starts for me with leadership, from the trustees to the senior leadership team, and then down through the organization. If you get those things I talked about, integrity, culture, values, behaviors, right at the top, sort of cascades down through an organization. So it sort of starts flowing through the veins of everything the organization does. And very impactful organizations who get it right feel the effect of that. The opposite, Sabrina, is also true. If there's the wrong cultures, the wrong values, the wrong behaviors, that will cascade down through an organization. And that's when it becomes a constraint, in my view. So I think the first thing to understand is, what is good governance, essentially?
I'm glad you said that, because actually I wanted to ask you, from your point of view and around the topic today, can you, for the listeners, define what is good governance, maybe from that strategic point of view?
Good governance from a strategic point of view is having clarity about the direction of travel the charity is going to take, and then having the right processes and procedures to help you on that journey. And those processes and procedures have two things. They make sure the journey is as smooth as possible, but you will inevitably hit bumps along the roads. And if you have the right good governance framework in place, that helps you stress test. So when things go wrong, and Sabrina, things will always go wrong. That's one of the things that I think that charities need to be bolder about. Even the Charity Commission's regulator says, because of the very nature of who charities are trying to help, because of what they're doing, because of the very challenging environments in which they're operating, problems will occur. And good governance allows you to manage those well, and it stress tests that when those problems occur, you're actually handling them properly, and then you will be learning from what's happened to strengthen the organization going forward. I should say, one thing I didn't mention, Sabrina, is that I have myself significant board level experience, probably in different guises, probably coming up to about 15 years now. So I really understand how sometimes you feel hot under the collar with these kind of things. There will be times when you are challenged, when you're in leadership and you're responsible for what's happening within the organization and specifically for ensuring that it's handled well. There will be challenging times, but if you've got that framework around the integrity, the behaviors, the culture right, that will help you through the choppy waters and it will help you get back onto calm waters for what your organization is there to do, and it will help you deliver on that mission, even in the difficult times.
That's a great answer. And I really love how you have called out these four elements: integrity, culture, values, and behavior. And also just really simply the fact that it starts at the top. If you have leadership or management that is not good, strong, ethical, fair, kind, even to go so far as to say kind, you're going to have a problem. I have talked to so many people who have described working environments that were hostile, working environments where bullying was rampant, working environments where there was discrimination, and these environments within the third sector that just are horrific for anybody to have to work in. And people go, oh, but we're doing so much good in the world. So, you know, suck it up and keep moving forward. And we've got to acknowledge that in the third sector. And I think what you're talking about when it comes to governance is it's not just structures. Like you said, it's not just compliance. It genuinely is, like you were saying, the blood in the veins of the organization. And I think that's a really great way to think about it when you're approaching the question, do we have good governance in our organization?
Absolutely. And the two things I would say, you and I have a very similar background, actually, Sabrina, in terms of having started on the legal side and then having all these different perspectives. I remember being told 23 years ago that the one thing I'd need to work on was that I was too kind and as a leader. And I remember saying, kindness in leadership is a strength. And that sometimes means being tough. It sometimes means taking really difficult decisions, but you can do so with the right approach. What I think within the third sector is that if we can't get it right, if we can't lead the way ourselves on this, working within a sector that should have all the things I've talked about and what you've mentioned, kindness seeping through its veins, who is going to get this right? There's a bigger picture here about why all of this matters and why the third sector needs to lead on this. And I was really pleased to see the Charity Commission work with the sector about the issues of bullying and harassment that occur within the sector itself and calling it out and literally saying, there is no place for this in our sector. There literally is no place for this. The other aspect of good governance, because there is a second part of this that takes it from those principles into the practical for me, is people sometimes fail to see the cross-operational element of how good governance fits together. I sometimes describe it as a jigsaw. I sometimes describe it as a stick of rock, and I'll try and do both for you. In terms of the jigsaw, when you take what we've talked about and you're dealing with a particular area, whether it's safeguarding or the financial viability, those are all pieces that fit together with the charitable purposes at the center and the mission at the center of the jigsaw. They fit together to give you the full picture of the raison d'etre of your organization and what it's trying to do. If you fail to see how good governance crosses over all of those elements and have a consistent approach in terms of integrity, cultures, values, behaviors across all elements, you end up with organizations trying to fulfill good governance duties in silos. They look at it specifically at that area that they are considering at that point in time. And that's where the gaps can sometimes occur, which can then lead to the problems that arise because you're not fitting it all together and you're not creating that overall picture. As I said, the other way that sometimes people understand it, that old-fashioned stick of rock, I think they're now called fruity flavor sticks of rock, but the multicolored ones. What I see good governance is your mission, your charitable purposes are the white bit of the stick of rock that runs through the entire thing. And all the other elements that you need to look at, particularly from a compliance perspective, are the different colours that meld in one into each other. And if you chopped up that stick of rock, they would all be there. Each little piece would be surrounded by what you need in order to deliver the mission. So that in higher principle terms is what it's all about for me.
I think those are great examples. I think that if we look at governance as, like you were saying, really the core, it's a way to stand back and take a deep breath and say, what is it that we're here for? What are we trying to achieve? And I'm really happy to hear, too, that the Charities Commission is starting to take a look and a stand on bullying in the charity sector. I think the charity sector, while our product, if you want to put it that way, you know, is this social impact and social good, just because our product is social impact, it doesn't give us a pass on being kind. I was chatting with someone I met at a recent conference, and one of the things that he said was there's a difference between being nice and being kind. And I think what you said about sometimes you have to be tough, sometimes you have to really put your foot down and you have to govern and you have to make decisions, but you can do them in a kind way. That I really do actually think should be a core element of governance as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think there is one difference between the third sector and any other sector that you work in, and that is public expectation. So we are funded by the public. They expect those values. They're let down when the values aren't there or the integrity is not there, or they see an organization or a particular subsector within the charity sector not living up to the values that they think, and rightly think, the charity sector as a whole should have. So I think that there's a higher imperative for the charity sector and the third sector to get all of this right and to lead from the front on it.
That's an excellent point. When you put it that way, that makes a lot of sense. So one of the things that you said earlier was about how charity organizations, and I think you were saying this also in reference to the Charity Commission, was that they understand that charity organizations, nonprofit organizations, are working in fairly challenging environments. And so they're also encouraging them to be bold. And I like that way of thinking, is that charities need to be bold. They need to be bold, not reckless, but they need to be bold. They do need to be innovative. And being bold raises a lot of risks. And so we're here talking about how to manage risk in the third sector. So being bold can generate threats, but it can also generate opportunities. So can you talk a little bit about, from your point of view, if someone says charities need to be bold, how does that link to governance? And then how does that link to risk management?
Okay, so two things I'd say. I was lucky enough to do a co-presentation with the then head of policy at the Charity Commission. This is quite a few years ago. The commission had already put its head above the parapet on this. And what she said was, in the past, charities could be observed as being quite risk averse, but you've hit the nail on the head, Sabrina. It's about risk and reward. Risk has things that you have to manage to avoid certain situations materializing, or if they do, to manage the impact of them. But when you take risk, you can get reward. And what she specifically said was charities that are over-conservative, too conservative with a small c, and are trying to avoid any risk whatsoever, the biggest risk that they're taking is not actually delivering the impact that they could. And I think that if charities saw it through that lens, this whole thing of risk, they might become, and particularly charity trustees, might become a little bit more comfortable with taking risk and then knowing that it's about risk management rather than avoiding risk in the first place. Managing the challenge that they're going to face, having identified them, having looked at ways, actively looked at ways to minimize, mitigate, avoid, but then going forward boldly because it's worth it. They've made that judgment. It's worth pursuing that particular course because of the impact, because of the ultimate objective. I think it's what you describe as objective-led risk, essentially. And whether you're looking at, I'd say the top risks at the moment for charities are financial viability. And would say in nearly, well, over 25 years now, this last 3 or 4 years is the most challenging period that I've ever seen the charity not-for-profit sector endure. It is a different period that we're all experiencing, starting with the pandemic and then the series of things that have continued to create challenges for the sector. So financial viability is something, in very practical terms, safeguarding and protecting people. Now, even that term, Sabrina, if I think back to the late 1990s, if somebody came in and said, oh, safeguarding concern, your mind would immediately turn to, oh, is this a charity that's working with children or vulnerable adults? Actually, safeguarding and protecting people, it's the latter, is a much broader concept. It covers the things we've talked about, like bullying and harassment. It applies to every charity and every environment that a charity is working in. So that is something that is really mushroomed from a governance perspective in terms of having a charity and its trustees needing to have their eye on the ball. We've had equity, diversity, inclusion and equality rise up the priority ranks, particularly since the murder of George Floyd, frankly. Accountability is something that I think that has risen up the ranks and something that charities have, in my view, always struggled with, conflicts of interest. Those are my five things in practical terms that I see charities either consistently having to deal with or in terms of safeguarding and, as I call it, EDIE, elements around good governance that have become core to what charities have to manage.
That is such a thorough and deep answer, Clarice, and you have raised so many things. I want to start, though, on the risk topic that you were saying. Risk, as people have heard me say, is a coin with two sides. One side is threats and the other side is opportunities. And too often, charities and nonprofits just look at the threats. They only say, oh, well, this could go wrong. This could go wrong. This could go wrong. This could harm our reputation. This could harm a beneficiary, you know, whatever it is. And they don't see exactly what you said, that opportunity to actually create a bigger impact. And you're right. It's about how you manage it. It's about how you're aware of it. It's about how you identify what you want to achieve. And then you say, what am I going to actively monitor, right? For the things that I can't control. And then what am I going to mitigate for the things that I can't? And it's not this black box. It's not this horrible, heavy lift. It's really just sitting there, like you were saying, and saying, from a strategic governance point of view, how do we want to do this? How do we want to make the biggest impact for the mission and purpose of our organization? So what you're talking about and how governance weaves through all of this, it's very, very important for risk management as well to have that point of view on governance. So I really like how you were describing what Be Bold means to you. But let's go into these other elements that you were mentioning. Financial viability, yeah, it's been really tough out there. I have a lot of fundraiser friends and business development friends, and it's a tough environment. Is there anything that you want to talk a little bit about when it comes to financial viability and governance and risk, sort of that strategic point of view?
Yeah, I really do think, again, it is tough out there, but there are opportunities out there as well. And therefore, it's about strategic planning and it's about knowing your direction of travel. What I would say is I think people need to have their eye on the ball far more, not just on the immediate, but, you know, the 1 year down the line, the 3 years down the line, and actively monitor that, basically, looking for the opportunities that do exist. So I'll give you one example. Funders pre-pandemic were very prone to giving grants with restricted funding. The pandemic happens, and all those restrictions are lifted because they realize that some of these charities are going to go under unless they can just use the money. Not necessarily to use the money specifically in the way that they had discussed, but just to use the money to survive. And therefore, that's developed an entirely new discussion that can be had around funding. They would never fund for reserves. And what the pandemic showed us was that charities that didn't have reserves were particularly badly hit, and they were the ones more prone to going under. So now there's a different thinking, a more enlightened thinking around that. We saw great philanthropy through the pandemic, actually, as well as the challenges. So in terms of financial viability, I would say, yes, you do need to be really, really on the ball about the funding challenges that might be coming down the line and continuing for a while, but also have an eye on where those opportunities might open up. And it will be different for different sectors, I'm sure. But I'm not underestimating the challenges that charity is going through. Again, I think it comes to being bold and having some honest discussions with your funders and your donors about what you need, why you need it, and how that's going to help you, not just today, but tomorrow as well.
I just got back from speaking at the RiskIn conference in Zurich, and I'll put in a plug for Risk In. If anybody is around Switzerland in May of next year, highly recommend this conference, particularly for third sector folks. But I spoke there and my topic was risk management in the third sector and how private sector organizations can be better partners. And one of the things I said was unrestricted funding. Funding, right? We've got to look at helping the core purpose, supporting better governance in the organization. If you give your funds and your resources to a particular project, that project will improve, certainly. But if you give it to the organization, all of their projects are going to improve. And think about the impact and how exponentially you can have such better impact, more positive impact, if you're funding the organization itself. So we talked a little bit about that. We also talked about in-kind time. If you are an accounting firm and you can give some of your accountants time, any organization's going to appreciate that. If you're a cybersecurity firm and you can give some of your time and guidance, any organization's going to appreciate that. So the financial viability is an element. And I think maybe third sector organizations need to think creatively as well about what other resources could they go to their partners and funders and donors and talk about in addition to the cash. So I agree there. That's a big one.
Nail on the head with unrestricted funding. I would say a good halfway house is something called designated funding, where you're not putting any legal restrictions on, because getting a bit legal here, when you put those legal restrictions on, further down the line, if there's a more impactful, effective way, you're just going to be paying lawyers to find ways to lift those restrictions, aren't you? Either going back to the funder or using some of the powers that exist to actually lift those restrictions. But what is really key there is the honorability agreement that I would describe it in terms of when you say to a funder, this is what we're going to use it for, we're designating, we're not restricting it, deliver on, and then they will fund you again. And that could be a funder as small as an individual donor. The charities that are most successful will say, this is what we're going to do. This is our vision. This is how we're going to do it. This is the funding we need. And then they deliver that impact. And if along the way they need to go in a slightly different direction, they'll go back and fine tune that discussion. So you can actually achieve this without putting the control mechanisms that just means money's going to be used to unpick what you've done further down the line. And I saw that time and time again as a lawyer.
Yeah. One of the things too is trying to address that power dynamic between the organization itself and the funders and the donors. And an individual funder, yes, there's an expectation. But when we're talking about large institutional donors, private foundations, CSR programs from private sector companies, there is a huge power dynamic. And when I talk to small to medium-sized organizations, I really try and empower them to speak up and say, in a very diplomatic and constructive way, of course, address that power dynamic. And make sure that they are not committing to things or agreeing to things just to keep the donor happy. And I think donors, and this is something I said at the conference as well, have got to look at these charity partners that they're funding, not as vendors, but as partners. They have to reevaluate that relationship. And they also need to be keenly aware that that small charity is looking up at them and acknowledging that power dynamic. And while they may not feel it because they hold all the power, it's there. It's the elephant in the room. And so making those donors aware of that as well, and that they're coming to the table, they're open, they're demonstrating trust, and they're building that relationship is really going to be key as well when it comes to the funding issues.
And also getting funders to focus on what they're requiring charities to do to get the funding in the first place or report on the funding. Those things are important, but they need to be proportional. And if you have that relationship, you can do it so much more effectively than if you don't know each other well enough. It's when you don't know each other well enough that I feel charities sometimes feel they're being asked to jump through hoops and think about the time and the cost for each hoop you're asking them to jump through. And I know some philanthropists have taken a more enlightened view about this in terms of audit trails they're expecting and in terms of the application process in the first place. They're actually funding based on trust, and that there is a place for the due diligence, but it has to be proportional is what I would say.
Absolutely, Claris. You are singing my tune. Let's move on to safeguarding. When we're talking about safeguarding, and you raised an excellent point again, that's not just about, are you working with children? It's vulnerable populations. It's your staff. When we're talking about safeguarding and governance and strategy and risk, what are your thoughts on that topic?
Well, first thing I would say, and this came from the pandemic, actually, remember that any of us could end up being in a vulnerable position. And right at the start of the pandemic, what somebody very insightfully saw was usually with charities and work within the third sector. You'll have Group A who are experiencing a particular situation and they're in need. And you'll have Group B that's isolated from that who can help Group A. What I think the pandemic taught us is we could all end up being in Group A, basically. So the first thing I would say is be open-minded. This is what protecting people is all about. It could be anybody. It could be somebody who in normal situations doesn't need help, but is thrown into one of those situations because of a war, because of whatever's happened around them, essentially. So that's the first thing I would say about safeguarding and protecting people. It's a much broader concept than we historically have seen it as. The second thing is it applies internally as well as externally. So it applies to anybody that comes in contact with the charity through its work, its staff, its volunteers. And that's why it all goes back to the values, the behaviours, the culture, the integrity of the organisation. You get that right and you'll get safeguarding and protecting people right as well. What we saw with some of the safeguarding abuses and the safeguarding scandals, the thinking on this has developed exponentially since, I'd say, 2010, 2011. When we saw those safeguarding issues. Two things. One, things that in the past may not have been revealed will now. Because of social media, anything an organization does, it will eventually come out in the public domain. The second, you're concentrating on safeguarding and protecting people because that is your duty and it is the right thing to do. But understand the impact it has on other areas, including your financial bottom line. So, for example, when the scandal about the international disaster relief sector hit the media, one of the biggest organizations that was hit by that reported in the month after over 7,000 regular donors just stopped donating. And it didn't stop there. They weren't allowed to apply for government funding. And just as they were allowed to get back on that list, more incidents were revealed and they were back off the list again. It will impact in a very significant way your financial bottom lines. And that comes back to that point that I was talking about, good governance transcending everything that you do. So I would say about safeguarding and protecting people, it's one of the areas that charities absolutely have to get right. But reputationally, it can have such significant impact that, you know, at your peril, do you not get it right, really?
That makes a lot of sense. And I like how you're tying it back to the integrity, culture, values, and behavior. And as you were talking, I was thinking, and you said it, you know, we want to do safeguarding because it's the right thing to do. And you want that to be the driving factor behind these behaviors within your organization. And at the same time, if that's not enough, hey, yeah, with social media, your reputation's on the line. So it's a carrot and a stick thing, right? It's this is the right thing to do, but watch out because everything is available. There's a lot more transparency, at least when it comes to the awareness of these things than there were in the past. So similar to safeguarding the equity, diversity, and inclusion element, I was thinking about this, and again, from my own experience working in an organization where you were saying in the beginning how some leaders think that governance is a constraint and think of it as something that's going to quash innovation. So I've worked in organizations where I've proposed strengthening certain areas of governance. And the response is, oh, no, we won't be able to be, you know, agile. We won't be able to be innovative. And, you know, me sitting here going, really trying to document how you're going to get reimbursed after a trip is going to quash innovation? Come on. And so I've absolutely heard that myself when it comes to governance and innovation. And taking this back to equity, diversity, and inclusion, those, now you're seeing all these studies that come out that say the more diverse, the more inclusive, the more equitable your organization is, actually, the more creative and the more innovative it is. So these things all make sense and we know them to be true in our heart. Why are we not doing them? What's the challenge there?
So I don't think people have really drilled down into this enough. The studies are now there. So the bottom line is organizations that are fair, diverse, and inclusive outperform those that aren't. Not just in the third sector, in every sector. You're absolutely right that the driver was that moral and societal case. But what I find is really impactful to people who go, yes, of course, but then don't take the next steps is, and now can we talk about the business case reasons? And for me, the business case reasons for embedding equity, diversity, inclusion, and equality into everything that you do as an organization fall into four categories: the market case reason, the operational case reason, the results and outcomes, and the purpose case reason. So I think you have to have these discussions around your board table and then again cascading right down through the organization so everybody understands and buys into it. Something I haven't said about governance, about risk, about EDI, about safeguarding, it's everyone's responsibility. So everyone should see themselves as a good governance person or a person that I can identify the risks in whatever they're doing within the organization and therefore manage it. But you can only get that when you've got a clear message as to why it's so important.
And to just hit on the last topic that you had talked about was accountability. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on when you say accountability, what does that mean? Because that can mean different things to different people. And again, what does accountability mean when it relates to governance and strategy and risk?
Okay, so some people, when they think about accountability, again, they go straight to compliance. Accountability for me is about what is it that you would say you would do, whether it's your values, whether it's delivering on your mission, and what did you then do? Are you living your values? Are you living what you said and what you promised you would do? Again, accountability starts at the top. And if everybody understands that, at every level, people will understand their role in making sure the organization is accountable. Not just compliance, but when a problem goes wrong, how openly and transparently are we dealing with this? How properly are we handling this? And how are we trying to learn the lessons to either avoid it happening, or if it does happen, to minimize the impact of what's happened? So accountability, again, has a much broader understanding, or we need to have a broader understanding of accountability within the sector than that specific compliance. What do I need to do in order to make sure that I have ticked all the boxes on my checklist?
I might even go a step further, Clarice, and let me know if I'm off the path here. But when I also think about accountability, I also think about the ability for people to speak up and speak out, and then what the organization does with that. Having that, people are calling it psychological safety, whatever we want to call it. But if somebody speaks up and says, I'm being bullied right now by a C-suite executive, the person that speaks up isn't fired 6 weeks later, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that is at its core a really basic thing. But apparently for a lot of organizations, that's not the reality they live in. So I would also add that speak up, speak out element to accountability as well.
Yes. If you do not have a culture that allows every person in the organization to speak truth to power, there is something really significant missing. And again, it's going to result in putting glass ceiling on the impact of what you can do. So this is why I think people really need to just pause and understand the importance of all of this to what they're trying to do. I sometimes think of it in terms of, if someone external shone a spotlight, what would they see? And what would the impact be of what they see? And if you look at it from not internal, because sometimes we're on the front line, we're firefighting, aren't we? But that external, that's what somebody 2-3 steps removed might see, think, and the consequences might be. That's, I think, a healthier way to look at things.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go into the business case elements now that you were talking about, because this is a question that I always ask is, if somebody is listening today and saying, okay, good governance, we all know that we need to do it. We know that's expected of us. But maybe there's an organization out there right now, someone's listening, and they're going along that maturity spectrum. They're going from small, scrappy startup to more established, medium-sized organizations. So what does that business case look like? You had mentioned market, operations, results and outcomes, and purpose. Could you just go through each one of those and describe to people how can they make that case, maybe if they're a mid-level manager to senior management, or if they're senior management to the board?
So, yeah, and specifically thinking about it through the lens of equity, diversity, inclusion, and equality. If the first thing in terms of market case is, who is your market? Who are your stakeholders? And when I do this work with boards, the list is really long. You then look at those stakeholders, because it's not just the people that you exist to support or help. It might be those around them. It might include your donors, your funders. It might include include commercial organizations that you're partnering with. It might include the general public, depending on who you are and what you're doing. What you can say is when people get things wrong, fundamentally, when organizations get something really fundamentally wrong from a good governance perspective, and particularly from that equity, diversity, inclusion perspective, stakeholders now will hold you to account. And we've seen this beyond the charity sector, but also within the charity sector. You get it wrong, they will walk away. I talked about the international disaster relief subsector. We've also seen it within the cricket subsector here. Commercial partners who have got a commercial arrangement with you don't want to be associated with you, and they will walk away. Even now, I'm seeing increasingly when people are tendering and partnering with organizations, they're saying, what are your values? What is your culture? What is your approach to equity, diversity, and inclusion? Funders are asking that. Are you diverse at board level and below within your organization? So your market case is really understanding who your stakeholders are and what their expectations of you might be and what the consequences might be if you fail to meet those expectations. I also mentioned the operational case. That comes to studies that you mentioned. You don't have to take my word or even your word for this, Sabrina, because the research is all out there. From Deloitte, from McKinsey, from Harvard Business Review. Organizations that are diverse, fair, and inclusive, and that have healthy cultures, values, that have good organizational integrity, they attract staff, they retain staff. There was a great advert, actually. I think it was at Leeds Station that I saw it. And it simply said, inclusion.innovation. It's not rocket science. If you've got a group of very different people, they will come to things from different perspectives. Hence, the creative potential is so much greater. If you have a group of homogenized people, they've all got the same lived experience. They may all come up with great ideas, but from quite a limited viewpoint. So what I think operationally that diversity, inclusion, and especially that speaking up culture allows you to do, it allows you to get more of a 360 perspective on everything that you're doing. And that's why I think it unlocks the potential of an organization. And in terms of results, it will increase the impact it will increase your ability to attract. In a commercial sense, we'd say more clients, but you might think more funders or more partners to work with. It will increase your share in the market in whatever you're doing. That is now coming out time and time again in research. From your perspective, in terms of risk, it decreases the risk of groupthink. Studies out there now, time and again, proving. And again, I think it's quite commonsensical because with diversity, you might have people who go, hang on, have we thought about this? Because they've got a different lived experience. They might spot things that other people don't. So those are the kind of things. But ultimately, all of this leads for me to what I describe as the purpose case. It allows you to have much better decision making around strategy, around the way forward, around what the people that you exist to help actually need, and around the impact of what you're doing for them. So those are, in broad terms, the business case reasons that I think that each organization needs to drill down and specifically think about in the context of the work that they are doing.
Now, those are such great topics. And I go back to, in the third sector, we never have enough time. We never have enough resources. We never have enough hands, yeah. Right? And we are just moving at the speed of light. And what's motivating us is to do good. Right, is to have that positive impact. And that's something I think the private sector can't necessarily say that they have. But sometimes that motivation is so overwhelming and it blinds us that we don't take the time to stand back, take the deep breath, and think about these things. Because if we do, it's actually going to improve us, right? Taking that time to do the vision work, taking that time to do the strategy work, it is not wasted time, right? Taking that time to, you know, I talk about objective-centered risk management that you talked about earlier, to sit down and say, what are our objectives? Okay, what are the threats and the opportunities around these objectives? What are the causes around them? And then what are the preparation steps? That might take a whole day, but that is a day well spent. You are getting your team around the table. Everybody is focused on what are we going to achieve? And then people are starting to speak the same language and you're breaking down those silos and you are agreeing as an organization on what's important. So taking those deep breaths is such time well spent. I think that your four elements here, market, operation, results, and outcomes and purpose. These are really great.
The other thing that I would add to that is I have seen quite often what I would call repetitive thinking of, this is how we've done it, so this is how we'll do it again, rather than active thinking. And again, having different voices, different people in the room, and having a culture where people can say, hang on a minute, can we just explore this and work out the pros and cons of it, is so critical. It's that sort of active listening and active thinking process, so that you're co-creating a way forward for the whole organization. And then if you co-create it and you get the buy-in, it follows that it's likely to be more successful because everybody understands what they're doing, what their part is, what the direction of travel is. Specifically in terms of risk, if we look at the other side of the coin, the negative side of the coin, in terms of Lehman Brothers, one of the things that's come out in the commentary around that is you might have had the finest finance brains, but there wasn't the culture that allowed anybody to say, or encouraged anybody to say, well, hang on a minute, could you explain to us the nature of this product and what it means? That is the downside, I would say, of not having that active thinking. We're going into something new. Let's explore this. Let's actually discuss it rather than go straight from A to shall we do it, basically. So that strategic time that you talk about is so fundamental to this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier about putting a spotlight on things. Some folks believe that the board is really there to sort of be that spotlight. They're outside of the day-to-day operations and they're there to have that advisory and oversight point of view. You have a wealth of experience on boards and advising boards. And you know, as well as I know, that charity boards are volunteers. They're people whose heart are in the right place. They believe in the mission. They believe in the purpose. They probably have never served on a board before. They probably are really nervous about what their responsibility is. They probably don't want to embarrass themselves in front of colleagues. And certainly, they don't want to harm the organization. And so they need a lot of advice and guidance. So around strategic governance and risk, what are some pieces of advice and guidance that you give to these new board members? What maybe are some questions that they can ask, data that they can request, people that they can ask to come and speak to them during these board meetings so that they can demonstrate that good governance is really key to the organization that they are serving?
Well, one of the things that you immediately highlighted there, it's about the information flow that gets up to the board. So it's about knowing that whatever is presented to the board is the fullest picture for the board to be taking a decision on whatever it is that they're looking at. So having a good flow of information, an open flow of information, an efficient flow of information, because as you point out, board members are volunteers. So it's really, really important to value the time that they're giving and make your interaction between the board and the executive function as slick and efficient as it can be, basically. The first thing I would say is understanding or getting systems in place that have a good flow of information. Second thing is it's basic, it's understanding the duties and responsibilities. And certainly when I started in the sector, people would just be tapped on the shoulder, they'd end up on a board, and then they'd learn it on the job. Quite frankly, Sabrina, I equate it to parenting. You just handed this thing and it's a really big responsibility and off you go, learn on your job. There are so many ways now and so many great opportunities for individual board members to upskill themselves and for boards collectively to work together to make sure that they're what I call high-performing boards. One of the things I am working a lot with boards on, and I think it's really critical, you've got your board business, but it's also about creating ways of working together, because it's a small group, isn't it, when you have a board together, ways of working together that empower people to feel confident enough to ask a question. There should be in a boardroom, particularly for new board members, there should be a culture that there is no such thing as a stupid question. There are simply things we know and things we don't. And I think sometimes, particularly if you've been on the board for a long time, when someone new comes in, you forget what it is that you didn't know when you first started. So, you know, empowering people, having things like good inductions to help them understand the role. I'm working a lot with boards now on the difference between board function and executive function. And the rules of thumb that I give to boards are, from the board perspective, it should be, I navigate, you drive. We work together to co-create the direction of travel. And as the board, you put that direction of travel into the car. You then keep an eye, because there may be bumps along the journey. There may be obstacles. There may be the equivalent of roadworks that mean that you can't go the way that you'd originally intended. And that's your role, to then think, right, okay, strategically, if we can't go down that route, how do we manage this? And how do we, you know, carry on in the general direction of travel? Or do we change the direction of travel? So I navigate, you drive. If you then find, as board members, that you're, as we all do, we're human beings, you might be sorely tempted to grab the steering wheel. You've got that board, the executive function balance out of kilter, and you need to work on that. The other broad rule of thumb, I say, is eyes on, hands off, which goes very much with that, basically. But when you take on this role, often when people take on a trustee role, particularly for the first time, but even people who are experienced trustees, that have been trustees elsewhere, organizations, particularly small organizations, go through their own organizational development. And in the early days, you might have to have been operational. So it's working on understanding the evolution of that organization that allows you to get to where you need to be as a board, which is that eyes on, hands off, that one step remove. You're understanding your role as being strategic, oversight, supervision, check and challenge. But many people come to it from an operational role, and therefore, as a human reaction, it's quite a common human reaction for people to want to get their hands on things, basically, where their actual role should be to take a step back so they can do that spotlight bird's eye role that they're really there for.
I love those two phrases that you mentioned, Clarice. I navigate, you drive, and eyes on, hands off. Those words paint a picture, and it makes a lot of sense. I also really liked what you said in the beginning about the information flow to the board. I had another guest on who was talking about risk culture, and he was talking about how sometimes with boards, the information that gets to the boards has been, what he said, sanctified. So if there's a real problem and it's reported up from a team or a unit and it gets to the manager, the edges might be sanded down a little bit, and then it gets to senior leadership, and then it gets sanded down a little bit more. And by the time it gets to the board, it doesn't really reflect what the challenge is. And so how do you manage that? What's your advice to the board so that they can be sure that they're getting the information that they need?
That's about working on the relationship, Sabrina, and it's specifically about having a culture where from the top you say, we want to know the problems. We're here to help with the problems. You know, do not sanitize what's happening. Tell us honestly so that we can, as people not directly on that front line, support you in the challenges that you face. And that comes back to what we talked about right at the beginning about what good governance is about. It's about having that relationship all the way through the organization, that we're all here with specific roles for this overall mission. And sometimes things are going to go wrong, and we want to hear about this because we want to support you. I think when things get sanitized all the way up to the board level, it's because there may be a fear of repercussion or of a particular project being axed, maybe because of what's happening. But actually, if you have that more enlightened relationship, it might be that more minds will come up with more creative solutions. It might be actually that you will unleash the potential of a particular project. And actually, if it reaches a point that that's too risky, that is a strategic board decision on a big, major issue. You're not just looking at today. You're looking at the impact on the charity or the nonprofit in 2 years, 5 years, etc. That's what I think sometimes people miss.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, and trying to, again, make sure, as you were saying, that relationship there is strong, which can be challenging sometimes, especially when you're dealing with lots of personalities. And people who are asked to be on boards tend to be people that have strong personalities, because that's maybe why they're asked to be on boards. I don't know. Will you tell me, are there more extroverts or introverts on a board?
So that is a really fascinating area that I'm looking at. You get a mix of people. And some people, Sabrina, who are very strong, will speak up in their operational roles. You find a quieter in boardrooms. So here's some of the things that I have noticed from the board work that I'm currently doing, often a dynamic might be created where the same voices in the room speak up. And that can happen for a number of different reasons. Firstly, I think some of us are nurtured to speak up. And I would say, don't assume that just because someone speaks up that they feel comfortable about it. But they may have been nurtured to think, right, if something has to be said, looking around, no one else is going to say this, I will say it. Sometimes when people do speak up and others don't, it's because when the chair throws something out for discussion, nobody else speaks up. And for some people, that's incredibly uncomfortable. And that's come through in the work that I've been doing. And they say, well, I kind of feel like I need to help them out. But then it's always my voice. And there's a couple of really easy fixes for things like that. Just stick your mobile phone on for 30 seconds if you are somebody of that ilk. And nobody likes the silence, but it might be just that the same people react to it quicker. And I certainly did some board work recently and someone said, that's me. That's exactly me. I don't want to be the person that speaks up, but I feel compelled to because no one else is. And I said, honestly, 30 seconds of silence is usually enough. Alongside that, you have people who are quite reflective and they need that period of time just to think and marshal their thoughts. And if they haven't been given a bit of time to think, silence can be really awkward in a boardroom, but if they haven't been given that time to think, by the time they're ready to say something, someone else has already chipped in and they'll think, oh, well, they covered it. But they may not have covered the point from the perspective that the more reflective personality would. So what I do say to chairs is there's a quiz program here called Question of Sport, and there's a round in it called the Home and Away round. And the home questions are things you're really comfortable with, and the away questions are things that are outside your comfort zone. And I say to people, play that round. So go to somebody for whom it's an away question first, rather than the person who you might immediately think, oh, well, you know, that's a finance thing. Let's go to X, or, you know, that's a governance issue. Let's go to Y, or, you know, it's a safeguarding issue. Let's go to our safeguarding lead, because you want to co-create that decision. So actually going to the people who haven't been involved, maybe, who haven't been on committees, and getting their viewpoints first on whatever the recommendations are will help build a co-created way forward. And then the people that may have been more involved, or it may be their home question, can come in at the end, and you usually find that most of the points have then been covered, but not by the usual figures that speak up. The other thing that I am working on with boards is to say, yes, the chair is there. I think a lot of board members will sort of over-rely on the chair, but actually it's the individual responsibility of every single board member to help create that culture. So this is something now that boards are doing. They're having a session that may not be about business, but it's about the ways of working. And they're opening up more to each other about their ways of working. And it's really quite revealing. I did one yesterday and somebody said, oh, I always feel like the person who's the disruptor in the room. And his fellow board members were absolutely not that, but he was feeling uncomfortable in it. So I think we need to think about how we do that to create a safe enough space that anybody feels comfortable and confident to challenge, to endorse, to put a different viewpoint.
I want to go back to, you were talking about using silence. And I have to say, when I was doing investigations and you're interviewing people, using silence, people hate silence. It makes them so uncomfortable. And using it is absolutely a tool that you can get.
Absolutely.
To get people to fill the space. And then also, I really liked what you were saying about boards having meetings set aside to just talk about the ways of working. That is something that, again, this pressure to deliver, pressure to perform, we never have enough time, resources, whatever. But taking that step back and taking that breath and having that conversation just about, are we working the right ways? Let's not get into the what we're doing, but let's talk about how we're doing it is, again, such a valuable use of time. I think those are really great points, Clarice. I want to move on to ongoing education. And I think you had touched on it very slightly a little bit earlier, but things are changing. The environment is changing for charities and nonprofits. Risk is changing. Governance is changing. The Charity Commission is always coming out with new and different thoughts and opinions on things. So people who want to stay on top of this area, maybe people who are listening today who are just starting to more formally think about governance and good governance, like we've talked about today. What are some things they can read, classes they can take, podcasts they can listen to, people that they can reach out to learn more about this and improve the governance of their organization?
So here's my top tips, because a lot of the organizations that may be listening to this, Sabrina, will be small organizations. So I want to start with all the things you can do that are free and that are very accessible and that you can do around your own time, because it's not always possible to attend things at a specific time. My starting point would be the Charity Commission had produced a series of 5-minute guides that cover, I think it's now 7 different areas. They call it the core curriculum around good governance, and they are literally 5-minute guides. Each guide will then have links to where you can go for more detailed guidance, for deeper learning. So I would say that those 5-minute guides are where any trustee wants to start, just so that you know where the information is. So there's one, for example, on safeguarding. There's one on political activities and campaigning. These may not be issues that are regularly day-to-day issues, but if it happened, you'd know where to go. And then within that guide, you'd get signposted to further guidance. I work with a great organization called Getting On Board, and they had produced a free trustee learning program, which are 1-hour webinars, literally whistle-stop tours of key things that you need to know. And so that's another fantastic free resource. I really would recommend that listeners listen to your series of podcasts, because they cover such a wide range around risk and governance. But again, you can hone in to what's specifically relevant to you at any one time. Because I do think that sometimes trustees might feel overwhelmed, particularly if it's their first trusteeship. So one of the tips I would say is give yourself time to grow into the role. Don't expect to know everything on day one, because even if you're an experienced trustee, it normally takes 12 to 18 months to understand organizational dynamics and to understand board dynamics and what the strategy really is and what it's going to be moving forward. So give yourself time. And then the last thing I would say is articles and posts on LinkedIn. You did a fantastic comment. You know, we are all team third sector, aren't we? And I know there's a huge number of people out there who really try to, in bite-sized ways, disseminate the information that might be topical, that might be relevant. Also, third sector press, learn from other people's mistakes. And I think I picked this up in one of the podcasts that you may have done recently, you know, around risk. Just keep an eye on what's going on out there, and you'll know what the current risks are, even if your organization hasn't encountered it at this point. The other thing I should mention, the Charity Commission, they have an update service. And so you can sign up to that completely free of charge. And it will tell you, you can do it on a weekly basis, the things that have happened that week, basically. And you just have to, you know, skim, and you will find specific things that are challenging the sector. And that's where they put out things like alerts. So in the safeguarding scandal, they put out a couple of alerts that were really relevant to organizations, as I said, but particularly to those working overseas in disaster relief areas. So there's a lot out there, a lot of free support. And I'd hope that what most trustees would do is go on what I describe their own individualized trustee learning and development journey at their pace.
All of those resources are fantastic. I was not aware that the Charity Commission did that update service. That is brilliant. I'm actually going to go out and sign up for that. And one other thing is, we have listeners to this podcast from all over the world. And I want to say that, you know, there is a lot of talk about the Charity Commission, and Claris obviously is located in the UK, but the Charity Commission has a lot of really just good basic information. Yes. So no matter where your charity is located, it's a really, really good resource. So, you know, even if you're located in the United States, or even if you're located in Australia, or even if you're located in India or South Africa, wherever you're located, it's a great service. So definitely check out the Charity Commission's space and all the other things that Claris recommended.
You'll find that there are inquiry reports, so you can learn from other people's mistakes as to how they got into what I described, hot soup, and what the impact was it. And at the end of it, they'll say learnings for the sector. So that's what's really, really helpful. Most of it is just about basic good governance. It's not necessarily about the legalities that might be specific to a charity that's regulated here. It's basic good governance.
Wonderful. Excellent. We could talk for hours, but we are going to run up against the end of the time that we're going to have for this episode. So before we sign off, where can people find you? How can they reach out to you if they want to learn more or get in touch or have other questions?
I'm on LinkedIn, which is probably the quickest way and very easy to find because I've got a distinctive name. So that's probably the easiest way to find me.
Wonderful. Great. So everyone can reach out to Claris on LinkedIn. So thank you so much for the time that you have given us today, Claris. Your knowledge and insights into all of this are so valuable. And I really hope that we can have you back on Tolerable Risk in the future to talk about more areas that you've been working on. So thank you so much for your time.
And thank you for inviting me, Sabrina.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.